Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the new show at the Cohesion Theater Company. But now it's my pleasure to welcome to the program Congressman Barney Frank. He represented the 4th Congressional District in Massachusetts for 31 years until his retirement in 2012, and he was in the middle of the mix during battles over some of the most historic legislation in recent American history. Issues like Wall Street reform and Don't Ask, Don't Tell bear his unique and unquestionable imprint. And in a new autobiography, we get a glimpse behind the scenes in the Capitol during his influential tenure and the personal struggles Mr. Frank wrestled with as a closeted gay man whose political career was advancing steadily. The book is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. Barney Frank will be speaking about the book Thursday night at the Pratt Library, and today he joins me on the line from Berkeley, California. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
So the first half of this book, the anguish that you were experiencing about the fact that you were making the decision to remain in the closet about your sexual identity, it's heartbreaking to read. But given the climate at that time, you came out in 1987. At that point, you had been in politics for about 15 years. Given the climate at that time, do you think now, looking back, that you could have come out earlier?
Only a few years earlier. It is clear to me that in 1980, I would not have been elected to Congress if I were out. I mean, it was a narrow win in any case. I did think by the mid-80s, look, nothing important, I believe, in this area of basic social attitudes has moved as quickly in what I consider to be the right direction as the question of how those of us who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender should be treated. And we were making very quick progress. I probably could have come out, and I began to think about that a few years earlier. There was a complication. One of my close friends, since tragically died early, Gary Studs, we represented adjoining districts. We were both gay. We were closeted. We knew that of each other. And he got involved in a difficult situation. He had been emotionally, physically engaged with one of the House pages. He was censured. He had to fight hard to keep his seat. I couldn't come out while that was in the midst of things. That would have just complicated it. If that hadn't happened, I probably would have come out 2 years earlier, but not any much more earlier than that. I mean, it is true that things have gotten better. But by 1980, well, let me put it this way. In 1981, a Democratic House majority, a lot of conservative Southerners, but still a Democratic House majority, voted 3-1 to cancel, as it could then do, the vote of the District of Columbia City Council repealing the law against two men having sex with each other. So in a climate in which the U.S. House votes 300 plus to 100 plus to keep consenting sex a criminal act, that was unfortunately reflective of a considerable amount of prejudice still existent.
Sure. Of course, as you mentioned, the shift towards acceptance of gay people and gay, lesbian, transgendered, bisexual has been enormous and quick. And as that's happened, the LGBT community has gained considerable political influence that it didn't have 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and you've been a leader of that movement. What do you see the role of the LGBT community and its political influence moving forward?
Well, it's twofold. And of course, you know, it's relevant to talk about that because Maryland has been one of the areas where we have made the most progress in terms of elected officials. What was a big breakthrough for us, frankly, was when we had the referenda in 2012. And look, to be honest, there was a question about the African-American community and its attitude. And in 2008, when the referendum lost in California, 2010, the African-American community was somewhat against it. There's a very powerful church influence. And of all the states that have voted on this, the first one where there was a very large African-American population is Maryland, of course. And the fact that we were able to win in Maryland with the support of the leaders in the community politically, the members of Congress, that was a big breakthrough.
Yeah, of course, but it failed the first time. Failed the first time, and then
yes,
we won
did.
The second time, sure.
Mm-hmm. And what we... the agenda is very simple. First of all, it is still legal in most of the states to refuse to hire someone or to fire someone because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. People are sometimes surprised to find that. But there is no legal right to a job, no matter how qualified you are, in many states. based on your sexual orientation. Now, we have federal laws that protect people against that kind of unfair discrimination in every other category. The most important item is to pass a law that protects gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people against job discrimination. Next, is important to make sure that people, where we do have legal rights, cannot simply say, oh, my religion says no, I'm not going to allow that. Yes, you respect religion, you respect the institutions, but you do not give individuals a license to mistreat people because they say their religion allows you. Beyond that, I would hope that the LGBT community would, on the whole, be a participant in efforts for social fairness. That is, I hope that we are not a movement that says, you know what, we're okay now, and that's it. We don't have any more political concern. We have fought very hard to get fair treatment for ourselves. We've been aided. I mentioned African Americans. The Congressional Black Caucus has been an outstanding ally consistently for LGBT people. It has collectively a very good record. I would hope that people like us who have known discrimination and to some extent have succeeded in the fight against it would be there to help other people who continue to face these problems.
Barney Frank's new book is called Frank, A Life in Politics, From the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You served 20 terms in Congress. You arrived the same year as President Reagan. This book is in many ways a kind of treatise on the necessity of government and its potential for good. You are in so many ways the anti-Reagan. You know, his message was one of, you know, government being too much an interference in people's lives, and that argument still holds sway today with many people on the right. How do you reconcile the need for, you know, individual liberties and free markets and the need to be fair to everybody? I mean, what should the metrics be for progressives in terms of regulation and government presence?
That's obviously the central question. First of all, you begin with a recognition that we need two vigorous elements in this society. We need a free market. We need a private enterprise collection of entities because that's where wealth is created, by people's activities. And you have to, I think it's clearly best you do that through the free market with all the incentives. You give people incentives to work. You have incentives so that people who produce something that the public wants are going to make more money than the people who produce things that we don't want. We get more of what we want. At the same time, sensible people have always recognized, until we get the Tea Party, this is the first time a political party has essentially rejected that, that the public sector has its role, but so does the public sector in several areas. First of all, as we just learned from the financial crisis, the public sector has to set rules for the private sector. You know, one of the things that we were told during the financial crisis, some of the bankers, we asked them, well, why were you doing this? That was kind of irresponsible. And the answer was, well, we had to do it because everybody else was doing it. We were under these pressures. So the federal government sets the rules. Secondly, there are very important things for the quality of life that the private sector won't do. I believe that public transportation, trains, buses, subways, those are very helpful. You know why we have those largely public? Because the private sector walked away. There used to be private street railways, private public railroads, private inner-city railroads, and the private sector said, we can't make money out of this, so we're walking away. Another example. In many parts of this country, private sector entities made things. They were very prosperous. And then the economy changed. There was no longer need for the product. They went out of business. They left behind them environmental damage. The public sector has to come in and pick it up. And then there was also the question that there are going to be people who will not prosper in the private sector. And the question is, do you leave them behind? Social Security and Medicare, people should remember, are major, massive government programs that were bitterly opposed by conservatives when they began. And they are the two most effective things we've had in reducing poverty among the elderly. Now, you need to have the proper balance. And in a healthy political system, there's a pushback, well, too much private or too much public. For the first time, we have a group of people who totally reject that. As far as Reagan is concerned, I give an example early in the book, because I understand what people say about this. In 1965, a large number of children had brain damage because of lead, particularly poor children in urban areas, but children in general in the country. And then the government stepped in. Congress passed two laws, one that banned lead from paint and one that banned lead from automobiles. under the Nixon presidency, by the way, and as a result of Congress banning lead by statute from those two private sector products, the incidence of brain damage caused by lead in children is down well over 90%. So as I said in that chapter, there are a lot of children today whose brains aren't damaged, and they can thank the fact that the government was there to help them, contrary to Reagan.
In addition to the central argument about whether government's a force for good or not, is a pervasive cynicism about government and about the people who are in the business of politics. At one point, you write here, I think it's both legitimate and politically helpful to make my ideological opponents look not just wrong, but also foolish, especially if I can use humor to do it. And you, sir, have a reputation for being absolutely one of the funniest politicians ever to hold the title politician. But I wonder, some folks might think that that's kind of part of the problem. What about the tone of the discourse in Washington?
Well, that's a fair point. I think I make this distinction. I ridicule their arguments. I ridicule their what I think of their inconsistencies and hypocrisies. I don't go after them personally. I don't impugn their motives. I don't think that the one necessarily leads to the other. What I object to is this notion that politicians are all evil and conniving. Look, one of the things that troubles me, I'm a great believer in free speech, so I let people say anything. I mean, I agree with those who say that those jerks in Oklahoma, those bigots who were doing what they did, should not have been expelled because you have a First Amendment right to be a totally offensive bigot as long as you don't do anything physical to people. But if I had the power to say, okay, I'm suspending the First Amendment, I would take House of Cards off the air. That is an example of a distorted, bizarre misrepresentation of the motives and of how things work. So that's what I object to. Arguing that people are wrong about policy and are making arguments that don't make sense, that's important for debate. But impugning people's motives, suggesting that members of Congress are not trying. Look, even the Tea Party, I've defended Tea Party people. I vigorously disagree with many of them on most issues, but almost the ones that I've met, they're all sincere. They're not in there to make money. They're not in there to further some kind of conspiracy. They are people with grievously mistaken policy views, and I will do everything I can to ridicule those policy views, but I have to refuse to join in this personal denigration.
Former Congressman Barney Frank, his new book is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. Barney Frank will be speaking about the book Thursday night at the Enoch Pratt Library. He'll be introduced at that event by Mary John Miller, the former Undersecretary of the Treasury for Domestic Finance. It begins at 7 o'clock, and we've got information on our website at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Mr. Frank, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to seeing you on Thursday.
I appreciate it. I've enjoyed this.